showers for Northern Ireland as well, and perhaps a greater risk of the odd shower at Chesterlow Street for the Ashes. I think a very small risk today, but a slightly greater one tomorrow. Still an awful lot of play around. The start of the new week continues the showery theme, especially in the north, with the best of the dry and bright weather in southern areas. So not a heat wave, but certainly not a washout, Mairead.
Something for everyone. Thanks, Helen. Helen Wellett's there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now our book of the week, and more from Philip Hoare's recent account about a lifetime's love of the sea. His travels to oceans around the world have brought him to New Zealand. Is this the last stop? We find out in a final reading taken from The Sea Inside.
To reach Kapiti Island, I board an early morning train from Wellington. The line rumbles past colonial bungalows with verandas, eventually leaving the suburbs behind for a series of beach settlements. As the sea begins to reappear, in the distance lying low is Kapiti Island, its dark forested outline just visible across the narrow strait. New Zealand is one of the last places in the world to have been occupied by humans. In its 65 million years of isolation, it produced perhaps the greatest variety of bird species on any island, estimated at nearly 200. When James Cook first arrived in 1769, he claimed that the bird song, heard from the Endeavour at anchor in Queen Charlotte Sound, was almost deafening, as if 1,000 finely tuned bells were ringing. But within 100 years, animals introduced by the settlers were threatening that resonating abundance, and in 1897, in an early act of conservation, Kapiti was declared a bird reserve. A tractor tows our boat on its undercarriage, like a piece of artillery, over the grey sand and out into an uninviting sea. The wind in my face revives my hopes for the day. Every island, no matter how large or small, promises a story, a narrative of its own. Cook called it Entry Island. After an hour's climb, I break out of the gloom, onto the top of the mountain. As I sit to eat my picnic, a weka, sleek and brown, a cross between a turkey and an enormous starling, calmly walks up my legs in search of crumbs. I look over the trees to the sea far below, swirling around the island's rocky skirts. I'm on my way down when I hear someone singing ahead. Who would disturb this forest? The kiwi sleeping in their burrows, and the totowai pecking in the dirt? As I turn the corner, I realize the sound is coming from the Maori guide who'd accompanied us on the boat over. She's calling to a kakapu, a flightless parrot, invisible in the canopy above, and it seems to be calling back in return. Back on the beach, I pick my way over bits of bleached driftwood, shattered pico shells and cable-thick kelp, trepidatious yet determined to swim. Further down the strand, a fur seal slides into the sea and rolls onto its back, pressing its flippers together like a praying monk. These places smell of whale. The early morning bus winds its way through the steep-sided hills of the Banks Peninsula to the sea on its descent to Akaroa, Long Harbour, set inside a narrow, rocky inlet. The Banks Peninsula was named by Cook in honour of his patron, or rather, he called it Banks Island, since that's what his initial survey indicated it was. Then it was covered in trees, but these were soon shipped back to Europe for masts, leaving its hillsides bare. In 1838, Akaroa nearly became a French colony under another captain, Jean-François Langlois. Sailing on the Le Havre whaler, Cachalot, he bought most of the peninsula's land from the local Maori, who received, in part payment, 2 cloaks, 6 pairs of trousers, 2 shirts, 12 hats, 2 pairs of shoes, some pistols, and a few axes. Langlois set sail from France with his first group of free settlers, only to discover that by the time he arrived in August 1840, the Maori had resold the land to the British. Akaroa has not forgotten that it was nearly French. The tricolour still flies in the centre of town. Quaint gabled houses bear such names as La Belle Villa. But it's not its history that has brought me here. It's an animal, named after an Englishman, and now one of the rarest of its kind. I'm lying in my wetsuit on the wooden pier in the sun, almost falling asleep when I'm called. The boat is ready to leave. I clamber aboard and we sail out towards the open ocean. I chat to the skipper, a New Zealander named Ian, and Alan, his first mate, a young Welshman. The water here is turbid, the perfect conditions for the Hector's dolphin, named after Sir James Hector, Victorian director of Wellington's Colonial Museum. They are the smallest of all dolphins. Calves are barely bigger than rugby balls, and adults hardly more than a metre long. Unlike their acrobatic dusky cousins, the Hectors do not immediately announce their presence with backflips and breeches. Their subtle circular fins slice through the waves before you have the chance to establish what they are. Small and fleet, they prefer the sanctuary of cloudy coastal water as protection against predators, principally sharks. But those same waters make them vulnerable to human actions, subject to the pressures of a maritime nation which owns more boats per head than any other on Earth. The North Island subspecies, known as Maui's dolphin, constitutes just 55 individuals. As the most endangered of any cetacean, they are unable to sustain any more losses. They are on the brink of disappearance, here, at the end of the world. It is almost impossible to imagine that these animals might not survive the century, that I could outlive them. While the deeper waters around New Zealand conceal species of beaked whales that had never been seen alive, the sheer energy of these diminutive cetaceans so close to shore seems to defy any notion of extinction. There's something cartoon-like in their rounded dorsals, like the handles on continental coffee cups, the kind you can't put your finger through. Togged up and raring to go, I perch on the diving platform at the back of the boat, blowing through my snorkel and slapping the water with my fins. "You've done this before, haven't you?" says Alan. The skipper shuts off the engine and I leap in. It's terrifically difficult to tread water. The grey-white bodies begin to circle around me. It's like being surrounded by sheepdogs. Then they begin leaping into the air, showing off their beautifully marked bodies. Their black and white mask faces and striped bellies might as well be Maori moko. But my body declines to act like a dolphin, and there's as much seawater up my nose as there threatens to be in my lungs. Exhausted, I haul myself up over the boat's side. Sometimes it's better to watch than to take part. Back in the guest house, in a tiny room made smaller by lace and chintz, I take two painkillers and fall asleep to the memory of the rocking waves. I wake at dusk, still woozy with the sea. I wander through the empty town, closed up and out of season. I walk to the end of the pier, looking out to sea. I'm weary of being away, of shabby oil-stained shorts and basin-washed T-shirts, of being removed from family and friends by half a dozen time zones. I feel homeless rather than homesick, faced with the familiar strangeness of this place, so orderly, like home, yet on the edge of utter wilderness. More than anything, I feel abandoned, as I always have. My notebook sits on my bedside cabinet. Everything is invested in its pages. The postcards and dried leaves and ticket stubs I've stuck in it, the slivers of whale skin, the sketches of unknown places and animals. In the absence of anything else, it is my home. My life spiral-bound between black card, the anchor I let down. In my dreams, my head is filled with migrations and invasions, travellers and victims. All the while, giant albatrosses glide and great whales dive into abyssal canyons, and Hector's tiny dolphins play hide-and-seek in the water. It's time to go home. There could hardly be a more common bird. Yet you could travel around half the world and never hear anything so beautiful as a blackbird in a suburban garden. I listened to the first notes of the first song, a lone voice in the dark, joined by another, then another, until they form a circle of sound. From dawn to dusk they rise and fall, fit and start, from roofs and trees, announcing their allure. Their songs are asymmetrical, apparently random. Phrases are thrown out to be echoed by rivals, in the way humpback whales take up that year's song and repeat it through the oceans. A blackbird defends its territory all its life. Some may live up to 20 years. The same bird bobs and bows and runs across my garage roof year after year, looking up at me in turn. How can such a grey, wet day be so beautiful? After days of rain, I ride out at dawn, taking my chance during a brief interlude of dryness. It's May Day. The rain intensifies the smell of the morning. At the beach, the water is flat calm. A new shape appears high over the shore. The slender wings of a swallow, zigzagging its way from the sea to the trees, thousands of miles from sub-Saharan Africa. Later, I'll watch them from water level as they swoop within inches of my head, so close that I can see every detail. Blue-black backs as iridescent as a mineral, pure white bellies and rosy chins. I wash off the night in the water, my scrapes and aches numbed by the sea. My bones have become bows, all scarred knees and gnarled knuckles. None of us are the same person we once were, since the human body entirely replaces itself every 7 years. There have been at least 6 different times. The winter birds have all flown. Back home, I pluck up the courage to clear my mother's room, the bed in which she lay, and from which she left to go to the hospital for a routine operation and never returned, has not been disturbed for 6 years. Now I pull back the bedclothes, heartlessly. 24 hours later, it's all gone. The room is bare and empty. All the things I imagined as a child, all the things I feared, they're not at the end of the world, and they're not here either. I close my notebook and put it on the shelf, along with all the others. There's no such place as home, and we live there, you and me.
Anthony Carf was reading from The Sea Inside by Philip Hoare, which was abridged for radio by Katrin Williams. The series producer was Duncan Minchell. The shipping forecast is next, but first, sailing by.
Thank you.
Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 10th of August. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. Low 100 miles southwest of Iceland, 997 slow moving, filling 1003 by 1800 Saturday. New lows expected southwest Norway, 1010, and North Fitzroy, 1021 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, southeast veering northwest, 3 or 4, increasing 5 or 6 for a time. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. North at Sierra, south at Sierra, east 40s. Variable 3 or 4, becoming northwesterly 5 or 6 later. Showers, occasionally thundery, good occasionally.